final case on the calendar for this morning. It's United States versus Edward Searcy, case number 08-1086. We have Mr. Hessler.
May it please the court, my name is Daniel Hessler. I represent Edward Searcy. There are two things that are being appealed here. One is the sentencing process, and the other is the result. Obviously, they're intertwined. I want to start off by acknowledging that the court made a record that covers 9 pages of transcript. This isn't a case where the court said nothing. The question is whether the court said anything meaningful about the issues that the defendant raised. And in order to address that, I'm going to just briefly talk about those issues. This was a bank robbery case, and the first argument that Mr. Searcy made was about his career offender status. Searcy had a long record of mostly property crimes, but he was a career offender with a twist. He has two convictions for a crime of violence. They occurred 3 days apart in 1997. They resulted in one arrest, but they wound up with two separate convictions imposed 4 days apart. The sentences were identical and concurrent, but they wound up counting separately for career offender purposes because the two crimes were committed a few miles apart on either side of a county line. Had they been on the same side of the county line, it is overwhelmingly likely that they would have been prosecuted together and sentenced together, and he would not have been a career offender, and the guideline range would have been 92 to 115 months. The fact that this was split apart added roughly 5 years to a sentence. This is a classic situation of similarly situated people being treated differently because he had this county line separating his two different robberies occurring 3 days apart. He wound up being a career offender, or a different person who did the exact same conduct but without the county line would have been looking at 5 years less. This is the kind of fact that typically results in a below-guideline sentence, or at least exerts some significant downward pull on a sentence. And this was raised to the court, both in writing at Appendix 44 and orally, Transcript 7. And essentially, the judge didn't say anything about it. The closest he got to saying was this: defendant argues that his two prior crimes of violence occurred during a 3-day span. That's true, but the court reporter could have told us that that's what was argued. It doesn't tell us anything about what the what the district court thought of it. There's no judgment on this. The court's comments did not address how this affected its thoughts of the guidelines, the 3553 factors. Procedurally, it's ignored. And substantively, as evidenced by the fact that Mr. Searcy got the middle of the guideline range, there's no obvious indication that this got factored into his sentence. A second significant argument that was made was that Mr. Searcy turned himself in before the authorities confronted him. Earlier, this panel was hearing a question about how unusual it would be for somebody just to sort of call up and say, I'm delivering drugs. Well, Mr. Searcy got arrested on a very small offense that eventually got dismissed, and while he was in Cook County Jail, he said, I want to confess to bank robbery. And that was documented. It was put in the record. And it was argued that this was a sign of hope for the future, that a sign that less rehabilitation was necessary and that less deterrence was necessary and that less punishment was necessary. And that was presented again in writing and orally. And this was, in fact, a nice piece of mitigation. It's unusual. It doesn't happen very often. Whether it takes the case outside of the guidelines or not, it's better if somebody surrenders themselves than either not surrendering themselves or running away. This is the opposite. Court said two things about this argument. First, in transcript 21, the court said, defendant also contends that he stepped forward in this case and turned himself into police. Well, it was more than a contention. We had FBI 302s documenting it. Later, the court said, I have also taken into account that he has accepted responsibility for his actions by turning himself in and pleading guilty to this case. That one sentence addressing two simultaneous facts. One is the factor of pleading guilty, which is a routine thing and routinely results in a three-level reduction in the guidelines. And the other is the fact of turning himself in, which is a highly unusual fact. Is that meaningful consideration of mitigation? It's my suggestion that's not, that a half a sentence is not enough, particularly when the sentence that resulted, the middle of a very high guideline range, doesn't seem to show any sign of recognizing that there's mitigation here. The defense made other arguments which may not have gotten the thing outside of the guideline range, but again, significant, did a lot to bring the sentence down, that this was a nonviolent, weaponless bank robbery, making threats that obviously he wasn't going to keep, and the fact that Mr. Searcy spent a very productive year at the MCC. He got work, and they raved about his conduct. All of these are kind of things that would normally tend to pull a sentence downward. The record just doesn't show any meaningful consideration to this. And Rita makes very clear that a sentencing judge should set forth enough to satisfy the appellate court that he's considered the party's arguments and as a reasoned basis for exercising his own legal decision-making authority. When the defendant or prosecutor presents non-frivolous reasons for imposing a different sentence, however, the judge will normally go further and explain why he's rejected those arguments. That didn't happen here. Procedurally, there's very little the court did or said to indicate it considered any of Mr. Searcy's arguments, other than to say, I have taken those arguments into consideration. And that's basically a rubber stamp statement. If that's enough, then a court needs to do almost nothing. And subsequently, again, this is a very long sentence, and it doesn't seem to reflect the fact that there's mitigation along with the aggravation. I would like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, if there's no questions now.
Okay. Mr. Bisenthal?
We had you up arguing the fifth case today also.
Oh, you did?
No, it was a mistake.
May it please the court.
This is the second time I've called your name.
Oh, it is?
To my embarrassment, because the lawyer who I called in the fifth case wasn't Ms. Bisenthal.
Well, I'm glad I wasn't here for the fifth case. And
yes, that would have been quite
uncomfortable for me.
Okay.
May it please the court.
We're glad you're here.
Thank you.
Let's hear your argument.
Bethany Bisenthal for the United States. The procedural requirements that defense has just discussed that are applicable to a sentencing hearing were met in this case. When viewing the sentencing transcript as a whole in this case, when viewing the district court's statements as a whole, the transcript makes clear that the district court did exactly what he said he did. He did, in fact, consider the 3553A factors and defendant's arguments that he made both at the sentencing hearing and in his pre-sentencing memorandum. When looking at this sentencing transcript as a whole, and not line by line or even paragraph by paragraph, as it appears that the defense is arguing you should, but when looking at this as a whole, the transcript makes clear that the district court did exactly what it was required to under the law, which is to give meaningful consideration to the 3553A factors. Now, as the government's brief lays out, the district court in this case spent a considerable amount of time discussing the defendant's history and characteristics. The district court spent the better part of 9 pages of transcript discussing the defendant's incredibly extensive, incredibly troubling criminal history. And the district court also, in discussing the defendant's history and characteristics, discussed the defendant's substance abuse problem. Now, in addressing the history and characteristics of the defendant, the district court also addressed the defendant's arguments. The district court addressed the argument that defense made that the career offender status overstated the seriousness of his criminal history. And the district court addressed the defendant's argument that the majority of his crimes were committed as a result of his substance abuse problem. The district court addressed those arguments when it extensively addressed and discussed the defendant's criminal history. The district court considered those arguments. It just didn't find that the arguments were so persuasive as to outweigh the defendant's history and his characteristics in this case. Now, the district court also spent a considerable amount of time discussing the nature of the offense, another 3553A factor. In so doing, the district court specifically addressed another one of defendant's arguments, which was that the bank robberies in this case weren't that bad because the defendant didn't actually have a gun and therefore couldn't actually use a gun. The district court expressly addressed this argument when he stated, it may be true that the defendant didn't have a gun, but he said he did. He put both victims in both bank robberies in indescribable amount of fear and placed every single person in that bank in a dangerous and volatile situation. Again, the district court expressly addressed the defendant's argument, but didn't find it so persuasive to outweigh the violent and dangerous nature of the offense in this case. Now, the district court...
What was the government's position at the trial court on this county line argument?
Well, at the sentencing, the government argued that while there may have been a county line argument that the defendant made, that the defendant's criminal history was so extensive that any way that you look at this, the defendant was a career criminal. And that the two
convictions... Were there other convictions besides those two bank robberies that would have figured into the career offender?
No, there were only two convictions for violent crimes, and those are the two convictions that would have occurred on separate in separate counties. But as the government argued at sentencing, looking at the defendant's criminal history as a whole shows that his criminal history is incredibly extensive.
18 convictions?
18 convictions. On top of that, 16 arrests. So two of those 18 convictions were for the armed robberies that occurred in separate counties, that occurred on separate days, that occurred to different victims with different weapons. According to the PSR, one of the weapons that was used in one of those violent crimes was a shotgun. The government made these arguments at the sentencing hearing. The district court expressly acknowledged that the defendant had made the argument. The district court also acknowledged that the defendant agreed that, technically speaking, he qualified as a career offender. The district court then spent the better part of the next 9 pages of the sentencing transcript discussing the defendant's extensive criminal history. He expressly referred to both of those convictions, the burglary and armed robbery, and expressly stated that both of those convictions could have resulted in harm to others. So it was clear, based on the sentencing transcript, that the district court considered that argument. He just didn't find it as persuasive as the defendant wanted him to. Now, the district court also discussed the 3553A factors of the need to promote respect for the law and need to deter future conduct. In so doing, the district court, again, addressed arguments that were made by the defense. The district court addressed the argument that the defendant had worked while at the MCC and that the defendant had turned himself in to the FBI. The district court, however, found that the defendant's history and characteristics, the nature of the offense, the fact that the defendant has shown time and time again his disrespect for the law, that those factors outweighed the positive factors that the defense had put forward. Now, to require the district court to do more than it did in this case would essentially require it to come up with a checklist, to come up with a formula, come up with a number of months to assign to each one of defendant's arguments and each one of the government's arguments. And that simply isn't what the district court is required to do. What the district court is required to do is to give meaningful consideration to the 3553A factors. The district court did that in this case, and the defendant's sentence should be affirmed. Now, the defendant's sentence was also substantively reasonable. That sentence, because it was a within-guideline sentence, enjoys a presumption of reasonableness before the appellate court. No arguments posited by the defendant rebuts that presumption. The district court in this case rightfully and reasonably placed great weight and emphasis on the defendant's incredibly extensive criminal history. The district court in this case rightfully and reasonably placed great weight and great emphasis on the incredibly violent nature of the offenses that were before the court. The district court fashioned a sentence that was appropriate given the defendant's past, his history, his characteristics, the nature of the offense, and the 3553A factors. And if there are no further questions, the government would request that the defendant's sentence be affirmed.
Thank you. Mr. Hessler, anything further?
Yes, I have some responses.
The government suggested that the transcript should be looked at as a whole. The whole is composed of individual lines, and if none of the individual lines address the defendant's argument, you can't say that the whole does. The court did consider defendant's record. However, that record would have been relevant whether there was this mitigation or if there wasn't. It's relevant. The record is relevant. And the fact that the court then said he's got this bad record does not necessarily imply, therefore, that outweighs the other mitigation, because the court didn't use that word outweighs and didn't say the word therefore that outweighs. That's a conclusion the government is reaching, and that's just not one that's made in the district court. Speaking of the record, the record, it's a bad record because it's long and persistent, but the only way you can get 18 convictions is by having lots of small ones. Retail theft, auto theft, auto burglary. When they talk about burglary, because there was a prior conviction, it was in 1988 at age 17, and it was burglary of a car. The only two real big convictions are the two robberies across the county line. And with respect to the district court's discussion of the nature of the offense, the court said that bank robberies are serious. And that's something I also said in the district court, and we agree with. But the court's comments about that were generic to all bank robberies. They pose a threat to the banking system. They put people in fear. And a pre-written statement does not mean that there's meaningful consideration to what the defendant, this defendant, has raised. And if you look at your opinion in the Miranda decision, which is cited in the briefs, there's some quotes from Judge Derjagian, and a lot of them look awfully similar to the things that got said here. So to the extent that the court is simply reading something that's pre-written, it doesn't constitute meaningful consideration, and especially when it does not mention the arguments that are made. The court mentions them to say, defendant has made this argument, but that's not enough. That can't be enough. If that's enough, then the rubber stamp works, and that shouldn't be the case, and it's not right for the system of justice as a whole. It doesn't leave respect for the system, and it's not right for Mr. Searcy. For all these reasons, we would ask you to remand this case for resentencing.
Thank you, Mr. Hessler. Ms. Enthal, thank you to both counsel. And thank you to Mr. Tice and Mr. Chang for being here. You honor us with your presence. We'll take this case under advisement, and the court's in recess.